So what did everybody do this weekend? Everything cool? Just sort of your run-of-the-mill, quiet time. Maybe saw some friends. Leafs won. It's nice. Samsonov, shout out. Very good. What else? What else? What else? What else? Toronto Rock played. Nice. What else? NBA in-season tournament. LeBron. Yeah, let's start with LeBron's legacy today. Why LeBron has changed the GOAT argument with the in-season tournament win. No, this weekend was awful. This was... Okay, let me start with this. I got a lot of messages from people being like, hey, it's just sports, it's just sports, it's just sports, it's just sports. Hey, move on, it's just sports, hey, blah, blah, blah. It's no big deal. This weekend was one of the most crushing blows I've ever had as a sports fan. Flat out. Like, I can put this up against just about any feeling, any sinking feeling that I've ever had. My buddy, I wasn't on Twitter on Saturday. Like, I was like, I'm not doing this again. I don't have the power for it. I can't just sit there and scroll and refresh and refresh and refresh the way that I did on Friday. So Saturday, I get a text. And the first one, it was from my buddy Sam. And it just goes, ugh. And I knew what it was right away. And it felt like in movies where the person has to go identify the body in the morgue. And they have to pull back the sheet and you have to look at it. And that was me looking at the Shohei to the Dodgers tweet for $700 million. And then 55 tweets about how it's deferred. He's not even get this money. He's getting paid in IOUs. So that's good. Shohei Ohtani, he's getting the Bobby Bonilla contract where he'll be paid until, we'll be reminded of this until basically the day we all die. To the end of our lives, we will see, and this year, the Dodgers are cutting a check to Shohei for this amount of money. So yeah, after I go down to the morgue, and I confirm that is the body, right? You see the confirmations, and then you see Instagram Shohei has posted it himself, and he says he's sorry that he took so long. The hatred just starts to pour in. The messages from friends, from family, from just about everybody that I know. Like, this one was different. This one was different. We thought we were getting Shohei Ohtani. It went from feeling like there's absolutely no shot to convincing yourself that it was going to be happening. And was it Red from Shawshank? It's the hope. It's the hope that kills you. That's what it was this weekend. That's what takes this all into a different pantheon of pain for a Toronto sports fan, is that for a brief moment in time, you got to feel like Toronto wasn't the other in baseball. That you as a Toronto sports fan, that your hope wasn't foolish. Because let's all be honest here. Let's put the cards on the table. That's a big part of being a Toronto sports fan, is the inferiority complex and the belief that from so many people, like, hey, they're not going to get this done. The underlying pessimism that does come with being the only Canadian market that's in two of the major sports. There's that underlying feeling of, hey, why would someone want to come here? And we always have to defend it because we live here. We know how great it is in Toronto, but it's the same things that get brought up over and over and over again. And I'm sure a lot of you saw that commentary once Shohei actually did sign with the Dodgers, right? The this is better for the game take, right? That in some way, the Blue Jays wouldn't have been good enough stewards to even have Shohei Ohtani play on their baseball team. That, oh, what a grand victory for the sport of baseball that the America's pastime wouldn't have this great player going up north and playing in Canada. And so you're hit with that again. You're hit with this dose of the other, the other, the other, the other. And that works sometimes in your favor because I really think it makes the winning sweeter. It makes the moment sweeter that they are just ours, that people here are the only ones that truly do know the team, that, you know, there are often times where you'll bring on an analyst of some kind who's a big person down in the States, a big personality down in the States, and they won't know the team as intimately as we do here. We really know our teams. We do. Sometimes I think we're a little neglectful of the other teams because we're so hyper-focused on our own. But man, Toronto cares about its sports teams. And then we know our teams. I think that the coverage is deep, but there is always that, the other, the not the sames, the step sibling in the sporting world stuff. And it doesn't matter how big the market is and how beautiful the city is and all of the things that we have to offer. The easy narratives and the easy lines to draw are still always there. And so it causes, in a lot of people, doubt. And some of those things are real, right? Like, let's be honest. It is a different country. I don't know why sometimes we want to pretend like it isn't. It's almost as though if we as Torontonians talk up Toronto in a certain way, the rest of the world will forget that we're up here in Canada. That if we separate ourselves from the rest of the country in certain, like, cultural ways, or the way that we associate ourselves with the States, that, hey, maybe we won't be. Maybe America won't notice. Maybe they won't notice that it's different here, that you do have to pass through customs here. But it's there. And it was there all along throughout the chase, the people that never believed, and that they're validated right now, right? That there's a validation that comes in being a person that goes, well, I never could even start to believe that a team from this city could attract a star of that magnitude. And now you're confirmed. And if you're someone who did hope and you did believe, like me, and you did see all of the events that transpired and had it go, well, obviously he's coming here, and you locked it in, and you were like me, where you were having phone calls with friends and family, trembling, basically, not even really knowing what to do. Because that's the big thing with Shohei Ohtani is, okay, did he guarantee you a World Series? No. In fact, there's some ridiculous, I saw a stat, it was just absolute bananas, that in the history of baseball, it's like the guys who get paid the top contracts, the very highest of the highest, it's a short list of actual winners. For historical contracts, it's tough to win. Like in the modern day. So yeah, Shohei was an uncomfortable baseball fit, right? He was a DH. What was that going to mean for George Springer? What was that going to mean for Vladdy? Was he going to be able to play the outfield? Was he ever going to pitch again? Like, from a baseball standpoint, there was a lot of risk with Shohei Ohtani, as wonderful as it would have been to see him hit in the middle of the lineup. But what Shohei Ohtani represented was bigger than baseball. It was a validation point for this city. And frankly, I really do believe that it was something that this city and this country and this fan base needed. I know to some of you that's hyperbole, but to a Toronto sports fan, being able to land the number one star in all of baseball would have said to the rest of the world, you can no longer doubt us. You have to look. You have to pay attention. You have to acknowledge. And to the pessimists, it would have been, shut up. You have to shut up. You have to believe in Toronto. That was one of the sweetest things about the Raptors championship. Like, the ride was incredible. No doubt about it. The rim bounce was incredible. Everything about it, you know, the highs and lows, the game one where Lowry gets nothing and just feeling like, oh my God, here we go again, to the sweet relief of beating the Sixers, but the slog it was to that, falling down 0-2 to the Bucks and then marching their way back and having the Kawhi dunk happen. The exhilaration of every game you stole from the Warriors. The sweat you felt when Steph Curry got that wide open look from three and you thought for a split second that they were going to go to a game seven. Lowry fighting with some partial owner, right? It was an amazing, amazing, amazing journey. But what's the, I'm sure for some people it's Boardman gets paid or whatever, the quote. But to me, it was always Masai. Believe in Toronto. Believe in Toronto. Masai Ujiri will always be special here. And so much of that Raptors championship will always be so special here because for a brief moment in time, you had to believe in Toronto. You had to think, holy crap, they did it. We did it. You got to go down to a parade. You got to see the joy. And I miss not just the feeling of winning, but that feeling of connectivity amongst fans. And that's what was so fun about Friday, was everybody tweeting at the same time, the same stuff, and everybody sharing that optimism for once and kind of coming together and going, okay, you know what? It's not so bleak. It's not so dreary. We can have things here. Holy crap. We're going to get things here. And to go from that high, to go from that feeling of just, wow, things are going to change. Things are going to be different. Things are going to be hopeful. Believe in the city. The fans, think picturing the fans on opening day down at the Rogers Center, all getting ready and being excited for this baseball team. The immediate turnaround that would have happened for this baseball team. It's so hard. It's so hard to move off of that. That swing in happiness, that swing in optimism, that swing in positivity, that swing in civic pride. Like, if you have any civic pride, any whatsoever, then you understand that this was more than a sports story. That this wasn't just about a baseball player and, oh, you're all losers for hoping that a baseball player was going to come here. Oh, a baseball player doesn't affect my life. Again, it's what he represented. Shohei Ohtani to Toronto, I would argue, meant more to here than to any other fan base, especially given right now. And so, like, yeah, I'm sorry. I don't really care for the whole, like, well, it's better for baseball. Because guess what? Most of us in the Eastern time zone, it's tough to watch Shohei Ohtani in general. So, like, the idea that he's on this Dodger to this history franchise is like, yeah, it's kind of moot to me. What it was here was plain and simple. Shohei Ohtani would have been a massive moment for civic pride. It would have been a massive moment for Toronto's inferiority complex. It would have been a massive moment for a baseball team that has felt this entire offseason like this was essentially the only option. A fan base that was expecting a splash and is now staring down the barrel of an offseason that, frankly, is pretty bereft of talent. And yeah, now a fan base is searching for an identity. Jim Bowden, MLB insider, analyst for CBS, Sirius XM, The Athletic, 16 years as general manager and former executive of the year. It's a very long and solid resume. Thanks for joining us, Jim. Great to have you back on, man.
My pleasure. Great to be back on with you guys.
Yeah. Okay, so let's just start with this. Do you think that the Jays were ever truly in this?
I don't. I think the Jays were in it in order for CAA, the agents for Ohtani, to be able to get the number that they got. They had to have legitimate competition. And when the media did a poor job of misleading everybody, it actually helped Ohtani, because that's what moved the needle for the Dodgers and got them up to that $700 million final number. But obviously, you know, nobody wants to negotiate against themselves. If the Dodgers knew that that's where he was going to go, that where would the leverage be, right? So Toronto became a real threat because they were a real threat, right? I mean, it was incredible that Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins were committed to spending between $500 and $600 million to try to land Shohei Ohtani, which would have been, I think, great for the Blue Jays, great for Canada, great for global baseball. But at the end of the day, no, I think it was pretty clear that the Dodgers is where he wanted to be. He wanted to be a place where he had confidence he could win. We look at the Dodgers' track record over the last 7 years, pretty clear what they do. Geography-wise, he has a home down in Southern California and loves it. And, you know, the Dodgers checked all the boxes. So I think as long as the Dodgers were willing to be the highest bidder, that they were going to get the player. And that's what happened.
So those are the two things that don't make sense to me, or that I'm having a harder time understanding, is if he was trying to use another market for leverage, why not use the Giants, given the geographical location? And then two is,
let me answer that one first. Yeah, I'll answer that one first, because the Giants have no pathway to win. So the most important criteria that Shohei Ohtani had in free agency is he wants to be on the World Series stage. That's what he wanted. That was number one goal. That's why the Angels had no shot, right? Giants had no shot. Not that the Giants wouldn't be willing to spend the money, but anyone that was in the process knew that he wanted to win first, second, and third. That was the most important thing for him. And the Giants don't fit that mold, but the Blue Jays did fit that mold. the Blue Jays do have a rotation of Gausman, Barrios, Bassett, Kikuchi, Manoa, the left-hander coming, Teeterman. So there was you got Guerrero, you got Bichette, you got Springer. I mean, there was a pathway. He saw that. He saw that the Blue Jays are built where he could win there. So that's why Blue Jays over Giants, and the Giants couldn't be used as leverage.
Well, the second part, though, is the money element, right? Is we heard all along that Shohei, yes, it was all about winning. It's winning, 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 and culture and fit and all these different things. And, of course, money matters. Like, I'm not trying to delude myself into thinking, like, hey, those are the primary things. In fact, we usually talk ourselves into that during free agency periods, and then we see guys set records every time, and you go, right, that's how this happens. Like, George Springer didn't come here because he thought the Jays were going to win. Primarily, he came here because they gave him the extra year on his term. So he landed as a Toronto Blue Jay. But what I guess I feel like I'm missing here is he gets all the way up to $700 million, but then the money is deferred in a way that it feels like it's not even a true $700 million. Like, how much of this is just an optic thing for him?
Oh, the $700 million is an optic number, yeah. The net present value of the deal, and we don't have the final number yet because they're not releasing it. Eventually, it will get released. But yeah, the net present value is going to be between $500 and $600 million. And instead of $70 million a year, it's going to be between probably $52 and $56 million, from what I'm being told from my sources.
Right.
So that's where the net present value is going to be. Look, I think when you're going to make $700 million, and I'll ask you your question, if someone came to you and said, we're going to pay you $700 million to do your job on this talk radio show, do you really care how it's paid out? I mean, at that level of money, I mean, that's still, or at least in the States, you're going to at least get $350 million of it after taxes.
Yeah.
Does it really matter to you how it's paid out?
Well, no, but that's kind of my point in terms of why the Dodgers weren't even in on this thing in the first place. Like, what took so long? What was their number to begin with? Like, what were they operating off of? Because it really does seem legit that the Jays were offering north of $600 million. And I can't imagine that it would have been the same deferment plan, like, if he was going to come and play here.
Yeah. No, I mean, they were playing. I mean, that's where the Blue Jays deserve credit. They were there. I mean, I don't think the Cubs, I don't think the Giants, I have no idea what the Angels was doing, but he was never going back there. So, I think it was just between the Dodgers and Blue Jays, and both teams stepped up at the highest level to get the player.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the day, I think his preference was to stay in Southern California.
Yeah.
And that's what I believe.
So if it's really geographical, right? Because I guess the next sort of phase that you would look at as a Blue Jays fan, like, my position has been, how could you possibly blame Shapiro and Atkins in any of this? Like, they took a swing for the biggest
Correct.
Star in the, baseball. They had all the money there. They made their pitch. They at least had him hanging around, even if he was using them for leverage. Like, what did you want them to do? Did you want them to jump the market on Candelario? Like, did you want them to pay the price that the Yankees did for Soto, or something that would have been greater than that or equal to it? Like, I don't know if those things are right there, but I would say that the case could be made that if the Blue Jays were in a better baseball position, if they had a farm system that wasn't, bottom five in all of baseball, and they had a roster that had more playoff success, that maybe that would have been more intriguing to Shohei Ohtani. But is your position, again, because, like, it's Southern California, that despite what the Blue Jays would have done, despite what the Blue Jays would have had, this result would have been the same?
I think if the Dodgers didn't step up, he would have been a Blue Jay. So I think if the Dodgers weren't willing to go where they went to, he would have been a Blue Jay. He did like the idea of Toronto. He did like his visit to Dunedin. He was very impressed with the resources and the technology and the cutting edge stuff that the Blue Jays are doing right now. He was on board. He was very impressed. But also keep in mind his agents, right, led by Nesbitt of CAA. Remember where their offices are, right? They're right there in Los Angeles, 20 minutes from Dodger Stadium. Mm-hmm. Remember the agent, Nesbitt, has two homes, right? He has one in L.A. and he has one in Orange County, one up nearby the Dodger Stadium and one down there by the Angel Stadium. That's where he is. And if you're an agent, right, and you're based out of Los Angeles, where do you want your superstar player? Right mm-hmm. in my back door, because that's how you recruit players. That's how you build your brand, right? Because every visiting player that comes into Dodger Stadium, right, you're sitting right there with your number one client, Shohei Ohtani, who's a brand. Mm-hmm. And then for the Dodgers, this is going to be an international brand for them. It's not going to be the Los Angeles Dodgers. It's going to be the world Dodgers or the global Dodgers. I mean, You know, that's what they're trying to do there. But again, you know, I don't think he was quote unquote using Toronto. I think if the Dodgers had not stepped up at the level that they did, I think he would have signed with Toronto. And I believe that the Dodgers front office believed that. And that's why they went to $700 million, because they believed that there was a real chance if they didn't step up that he would be a Blue Jay. And I believe that as well.
Do you think the Dodgers changed their offer then materially in the 11th hour?
I know they did.
Yeah.
I know they moved on Friday. I don't know what they did Saturday morning, or if Shohei just slept on it and said, I'm tired of this circus, I'm going to make the decision. I think we're going to find out at the press conference. But I do know they moved on that Friday after all that noise was happening.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, it's a really tough time here in Toronto, not just because we thought he was coming here. It's not tough just because, it's kind of, you look really foolish. It's like you believed, and so much I was explaining off the top of the show today that being a Toronto sports fan is feeling like the other and feeling like good things can happen and that, you know, you're in Canada and so that's it and blah, 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 go on down the line. But I think also a big part of this is that a lot of people knew that this was Toronto's real out, you know, to kind of getting excitement back with the baseball team, because there's been this discussion of they know that this fan base, like the position that they're in, they have renovations to the building. They want to excite the fans here. They want to make sure that everyone is showing up on opening day with that hope and that belief in the baseball team. And yet it is a farm system that isn't loaded and isn't ready to make a whole bunch of splashy trades. Soto did come off the table. Shohei has now signed. And yeah, there are some free agents, Cody Bellinger's out there, and there are some others, but it really looks like a tough pivot for the Blue Jays. The question to you is, where do you see them going now? Like what is the next step for Toronto?
I mean, look, I think a Cody Bellinger pivot makes sense. I think bringing back Chapman makes sense. And look, just because you signed Ohtani didn't mean you're going to win. I mean, how many times did the Angels have a winning record with Ohtani? Zero times. And he's just going to DH. And maybe he DHs to start the year. None of us know that. We don't know what that second Tommy John surgery did to his elbow. You know, Bryce Harper wasn't himself coming back from Tommy John surgery. There's no guarantee he's going to hit out of the gate like they say. And by the way, there's no guarantee he's going to be able to come back and pitch in 2025 like everybody says. How many guys have come back from the second Tommy John? So, I mean, look, nothing was for sure outside of the brand and what it would have meant for ticket sales and what it would have been for the Blue Jays in the country of Canada. Yeah, it would have been unbelievable. We get that. I know it's disappointing. But you pivot and you just go build a championship baseball team, because honestly, at the end of the day, that's what the fans want. Mm-hmm. It's not the individual player. They want celebrations. They want a parade. They want champagne popping. I think you pivot to Bellinger. I think you try to bring in Chapman. I think you go get Rhys Hoskins. I think you consider, you know, continue to add to pitching. I know you have a great closer in Romano. Why not sign Josh Hader and put Hader and Romano in the back end? I mean, I think baseball-wise, you just pedal the metal. If you were willing to go $600 million for Ohtani, I can show you a lot of ways to spend $600 million and build a better baseball team than putting it all on one player.
Yeah, I'm completely agree. But that was the whole thing with Ohtani, right? Was that this wasn't just a baseball decision. This was a business decision. And that's why that money was on the table. And like you know this front office well. Do you believe that, yes, there's going to be a ton of money for them to spend? Or was this, yes, just purely Ohtani, and now you, like that scenario that you just outlined of, hey, now you're in on every major free agent, of course, like that's something that people could be excited about. If you told me 600 to spread around on a baseball team over one player, like the answer's obvious from like a pragmatic standpoint. But do you think that there will be real money there for the Blue Jays to be spending on upper level free agents, not just like one of them, but multiple?
Yeah, so this is where I'm from, and understand, I know I don't live in Toronto, right? Yeah. So when I look at the game, I look at it from a global, non-biased position. That's all I look at. All I know is since Mark Shapiro got there, every single winner, he goes out and spends legit money. That's all I've seen. Kevin Gausman, Chris Bassett, George Springer, Hyunjin Ryu, trade for Berrios and sign him. So, I mean, that's all I've seen them do. I mean, I've seen them spend the money, and I don't think this offseason is going to be any different than what I'm used to with them. Mm-hmm. I think that the Blue Jays have underachieved. That's what I believe over the last several years. I think their teams have been better than the end result. That's what I believe. I don't know how you take Jose Berrios out of that game. Mm-hmm. And then everybody tries to point fingers at people when it's the manager's job to make that decision. No one else's. It's his call, and he didn't take immediate accountability, which still perplexes me. But there is work to be done with this team. There's no doubt about that. But there's a core there. There's a core that and a pathway to get to the playoffs. And the Arizona Diamondbacks and the Texas Rangers were wild card teams this past year, and they got to the World Series. Arizona won 84 games, found a way to the World Series. Toronto's got to get in and find a way. That's it. And when you have a rotation of Cosman, Berrios, Bassett, you got a chance. You got a chance to win. So let's go fix left field. Let's go bring back third base or find a better solution. And let's keep adding to this team. You know the resources are there. You just prove.
I think we lost Jim. Yeah, we did. Let's just give him the old bounce. That's the cue, boys. Bonk. Okay. No one wants to hear this today. No one. So I get it. You can even get pissed off at me for saying this. I don't feel like right now the Jays are a true contender unless everything breaks their way. I'm not a big believer in the whole theory of like everyone is going to have a positive regression season. And that all of a sudden, all the bats that you watched that didn't perform last year are suddenly going to have some kind of a drastic turnaround. Do I think that, you know, on a balance of probabilities, that Vlad will have a better year? Yeah. Do I think that Varsho will have a better year? Yeah. Do I think that it'll be a material difference between, you know, what we saw with Springer and Bo and some of the other guys? Like, I don't know. Like, Bo's season wasn't, like, down. Springer is kind of turning a pretty big corner when it comes to his age. But yes, it's pretty obvious that the baseball team is a good one, that they have a good basis for they have a good foundation for the baseball team. I do feel like this is more of an issue right now with how they're going to satiate fans or how quickly it can turn if that good baseball team doesn't actually perform and what the temperature of the base is going to be if they come out of the gates with like a slow start or that they struggle with runners in scoring position or they struggle with base running. Like if some of the old demons pop up right away, I just think that this is a very, very unique situation in that, yeah, Toronto Blue Jays fans are going to have a very, very, very short leash with being able to, yeah, withstand some of the issues with this team. Anyways, we got Jim back. Hey, Jim, sorry, you were just in the middle of talking about the decisions that the Blue Jays have in front of them this offseason.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any question that they need to pivot and not feel sorry for themselves and just keep going out and building a good club. I think Cody Bellinger, who's won an MVP before, would be a great sign. I think he really figured things out last year at every single level, and he's young and he's in his prime. I think you bring back Chapman, you get Bellinger, you get Hoskins, and all of a sudden you're in a really good position. So that's what I'd like to see them do.
What do you think Bellinger commands?
Too much money.
Yeah. I was going to say it's
yeah. I mean, this market is such a runaway train. Like I watched Yamamoto's market go from 200 to 210. Now they're telling me 300 million. So it's literally changing what 100 million a week. So to answer your question with Bellinger, I'm thinking it's going to get to a disgusting 7 years, 181 million.
Okay. So he won't, you don't think he'll crack the 200 mark then though?
Oh, my colleagues do. Yeah. I don't know. I just, as a former GM of 16 years, I have a hard time giving him $200 million. So I got to be stubborn. I'm going to go 7-181, but I have colleagues that think he will crack 200.
Yeah. Listen, I think Bellinger was great last year. It would scare me to the deepest parts of my soul, giving a guy with a 654, 542 OPS, the two seasons leading up to last year with Chicago, a $200 million contract. Even some of the memories.
I think the one thing, though.
Yeah.
I think the one thing to keep in mind, though, when you dig in, because I looked at it the same way and I had a hard time with it, and he's just got Boris Klein. But when you dig into the shoulder injury that he had, and you dig into the ramifications of the pandemic when he got COVID and really zapped him, there are reasons to understand those years. He is now healthy again this year. He also made a lot of mechanical adjustments. That at his age looks like it's sustainable. So I'll defend it that way. But you know, I hate to spend that kind of money, but I think the Blue Jays have a window to win. You got to take advantage of it. I don't know what the better alternative is. I haven't seen Younghoe Lee. I know the Giants and Padres are kind of in a bidding war for him. I haven't seen him. I mean, you could always sign him, put Varsho in left, but I can't endorse Lee because I've never seen him in person.
Well, the other way that you go about it, I think, is through the trade market, right? Are there any names that are out there? Like, some people have mentioned potentially, you know, trying to target a guy like Christian Yelich. Are there names that you've heard that could be available for trade that Toronto might actually have a prospect pool to pull from?
Well, I mean, Soto was it. Yeah. I mean, Soto was it because of Tiedemann and Manoa, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Yelich's back is such that you can't take a chance on Yelich's back. I know he had a little bounce back year last year, but there's no way you can take any part of that contract with the back issue the way it is. I mean, it's hard to get a superstar in trade when your farm system is where Toronto's is right now. It's just not strong enough to make those kind of deals because you're competing with the Orioles farm system and the Reds farm system and the Dodgers farm system. So for me, for this team to pivot from Ohtani, you got to play checkbook baseball to get there, unfortunately.
Yeah, the only name that I think leaves a bit of intrigue for people in terms of what his value is Manoa. Like, because our Ben Nicholson-Smith reported that there were four teams that had at least checked in. But, you know, he came on the show and said that was a little bit more vulturing, you know, teams inquiring around, trying to pick the bones and trying to get a cheaper price on a player like Manoa. But do you think that, yeah, this increases the likelihood that he gets traded?
I don't think you trade Manoa now because I think his trade value is so small. Yeah. I mean, like, GMs will take a chance as a reclamation project, but we don't want to give anything up to get him, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
He's got to go pitch if you want him to have trade value. He doesn't have any right now. So that's kind of where that stands.
Okay, so last one from me. How is the contract being received by people in your circles? Because it's baseball, right? We're used to seeing huge money thrown around. And, it's Shohei Ohtani. We understand the business element of this. And, I grew up rooting against the Yankees. Like, a Blue Jays fan watching the Yankees just spend money after money after money and feeling like, you know, they grab Judge and then they grab Soto. Like, this is not a sport for small market teams. Like, it never has been. And I don't think Toronto is a small market team. But the money is getting to the point now where it's like they did put in this luxury tax. They clearly tried to create some type of added parity in baseball by adding, you know, an extra wild card team and by having these punitive punitive measures for teams that spend so much. And now you see something where it's like the team that has Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman already on massive contracts also goes out and spends, you know, $60 million a year on Shohei Ohtani. Like, how is there any conversation around baseball that's happening that's different in your eyes about, like, some of these top spending teams? Or is this just business as usual?
Well, I think it's business as usual because also keep in mind the Dodgers let Corey Seager go and they let Trey Turner go because they didn't want to pay either one $300 million because they were saving their money for Ohtani.
Yeah.
That's just the truth of it. And keep the Dodgers television deal with Spectrum is a 25-year deal for $8.35 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So all they did was out of the $8.35 billion over a 25-year period, remember, this thing is deferral, and it may be more than 25 years, all they did was take some of that $8.35 billion and say, we're going to invest that in Ohtani. So it's really affordable for the Dodgers. And to your point, who else has an $8.35 billion television deal, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the unfairness of the haves and the have-nots show up in a situation like Ohtani and Soto, for that matter.
Yeah. Hey, Jim, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on. I always feel like the audience gets smarter when you do. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Take care. There's Jim Bowden, MLB insider and analyst for CBS, Sirius, The Athletic, and, of course, 16 years as a general manager and former executive of the year. Okay, so let's go over some of what he said. I understand how some people are interpreting that as, like, the Blue Jays were always destined to be the bridesmaid. And he said, like, were the Blue Jays really ever in on Ohtani? It's like, no, but that's because he believes the Dodgers were always going to spend that money, that they were eventually going to come up and meet the offer. Deadlines make deals. But I think that you have to have a credible threat. And this, there it is. The Jays are a better constructed baseball team with more of a chance to win than the Giants. Was there another team? It was the Blue Jays. The $600+ million was very real. These guys were absolutely offering Shohei Ohtani from the jump the money that it would have taken him to come up here. This wasn't some ruse or a conspiracy or whatever other thing that some people have kind of twisted themselves into that, you know, this was for, I don't know, media clicks or something. I don't even really understand what the, or like ticket sales, like that this was the ploy. Is ultimately, again, this fan base is now down, lower than you would have even expected at the beginning of the offseason when it was Atkins doing his media availability that felt like it set this fan base ablaze with anger, with frustration, where people were just, I'm out right now. So no, I don't think that this was some calculated ploy to try to jam in a few extra season's tickets during a 24 or 48 hour window, like whatever. Anyway, I don't think that that's realistic. I think that people hear one story of something like this and then it gets propagated up into oblivion and people accept it as a reality because, again, it's a confirmation bias of what they want to believe. In reality, the Blue Jays were there. They had the money. They had impressed Shohei enough that if the Dodgers were not going to spend the money, they were going to be there. The problem is the Dodgers had that television deal and the Dodgers are the Dodgers, and so they were willing to come over the top. What hurts is that even with the finances, it seems, trying to read from what Jim's saying, that even though they went to $700 million, that it might have actually been an even less competitive financial offer than what the Blue Jays had, given all the deferrals. I have a hard time believing that Shohei Ohtani wouldn't have come here or would have come here with the same money deferred. But that overall, the Dodgers were just the place that he wanted to be. And it makes sense. They've got a loaded farm system. They're going to win 100 games every single year. You get to go play with Mookie Betts. I'd want to play with Mookie Betts. I'd want to play on that team. And you know that they're in for a penny, in for a pound. There's never going to be a scenario where the Dodgers now go, well, we probably shouldn't spend more on this player. It's no, they're going to be pushing in for championships. They have a margin for error. His doctor is in LA. His agent is based in LA. His home is in LA. It's easy to understand why this guy wanted to be there. And so the only part of this that I really don't care for when it comes to the woe is me element, because there's a lot of woe is me-ing, and I'm fine with it because I'm in woe is me too. In fact, listen, I have more to gain from this than a lot of other fans. I get to speak about a team. You think I want to come on here and just bash them and be negative and be like, I go to a lot of these baseball games. I really want the Jays to win. I want to see the fan base happy. There's nothing I love more than hearing the ma as the Blue Jays win. And I walk out of there after a couple of beautiful Bud Lights with a couple of good friends and feeling like, wow, that was a really fun night down at the ballpark during a beautiful summer day. And the question is like, what's next? Yes, the best. I want to pivot back into that. But the whole like bridesmaid used. Yeah, of course the Jays got used. Yeah, that's how negotiations work. You need to have another place. But the point is that the Jays were credible. The Jays were credible. That doesn't mean anything. I don't think that they've been getting flowers thrown at their feet. This isn't the You Came Close League. I'm not saying, oh, wow, they almost got Shohei Ohtani. They should move on and they should be forgiving other things. Like, no, there's even more pressure for this group to now come up with something that is exciting and something that is going to really make you believe that this team has a better shot at winning next year. Like, that has only been amplified because of this. This hasn't been diminished because they were in on Shohei Ohtani. But yeah, like, I guess I just don't really understand the whole, what the point was supposed to be with some people of, well, the Blue Jays were a bridesmaid. It's like, yeah, but they were there. They were at the wedding. They were standing there ready. If Shohei Ohtani, if there was a slip, they were going to try to capitalize on it. And you kind of have to hope for that. And I do think that is, it's not a win, but it's at least a positive sign of the direction of this organization, which is they're going to try to make sure that if another team is not willing to be there on everything, that they will be. That if the right player comes along, that you know, like he just said, Shapiro wants to spend money. Ownership just sunk all this money into the ballpark and into Dunedin. They're not looking for rebuilds right now. They're not looking to pivot and say, oh, well, now we're going to sell pieces and try to worry about another 3-year down period and then going forward. It's like, no, the Toronto Blue Jays want to keep winning. The Toronto Blue Jays want your butt and mine in the seats now. In perpetuity, it should seem. that this wants to be a different level of organization than it has been in the past. And it looks ugly right now because it's been disappointing. The team last year was like, there's got to be a different level of disappointing. It created an ugly sports atmosphere. And that's the pressure that they have right now. And that's what we're all going to be watching for is like, all right, you tried to get the big superstar. You tried to spend the $600 million. How much of that $600 million are you going to plunk into other free agents? How do you feel about these other free agents? Because, I like Jim's theory, and if Cody Bellinger signs here, I'll be on board immediately going like, yeah, I think the shoulder. I will tell you, though, like, I have seen this guy in playoff games where he was hitting, like, eighth for the Dodgers or whatever, and, I didn't feel as though he was a threat whatsoever. So I hope the shoulder thing. I haven't gone as deep on that as, obviously, Bowden has. I wasn't even really thinking about Cody Bellinger. I wasn't thinking about any of these other guys. My brain hasn't really pivoted to what I would think about some of these other guys. But yeah, how much of that money is going to be available for baseball players? Will they spread that around? Will they make some sort of a splash? Because they can't just re-sign Matt Chapman. They can't just say, hey, we brought back the third baseman that struck out all the time and was one of the worst players in baseball for months last year, who was part of the frustration, who was public enemy number one, or one of them anyways, when it came to the runners in scoring position thing. Like, that's not going to be acceptable. So they have a good baseball team. They have a lot of pieces a lot of teams would like, but I think we all agree that right now they don't feel like a serious contender unless there are drastic swings upwards for some of these bats. And should be noted that they're going to need to maintain their health when it comes to the pitching staff. Yes, they lost Manoa last year. People seem to be split on it. I think I'm just a little bit more overly confident in him because he was a guy I bought into day one, and I believe in the character. I like seeing all the workout stuff. I just think he's taking everything as serious as possible. And that, yeah, there is the odd player where you just buy they use the hate to fuel them more. And I kind of think Manoa was one of those guys. But there are other people that I've talked to that say, hey, the mechanical issues are bigger than you might think. And it could be a bit of a slower build that you don't assume that Manoa is going to come back next year and just automatically look like an ace again, which I just think is a fair assumption to be making at this point. But yeah, they're going to need a similar type of health from the starting pitching staff without really any negative regression from any of their pitchers. And I'm sorry, do you really trust that that's not a possibility for Kikuchi? Do you really trust that's not a possibility for Berríos? I think Bassett should age well, but he did just pitch over 200 innings and he's an older guy. And he has had a lot of down in his career. Like, you can point to some reasons to believe that that's not going to be the exact same. The bullpen is weaker as of today. They've got to find ways to shore that up. There's holes. There's real holes. Winning will cure it. A pragmatist would look at this and say the Jays don't have to do too much, right? There were 89 wins. If they can add a couple of wins around it, it's like, okay, cool. Get into it. Shouldn't be that hard to find a way to 93, 94, 95 wins with some of the additions that they can make. But the fan, like I hate when people do the like, and fanatic, it's in the word, but truly, like the person that just needs a bit of a shakeup, needs a bit of excitement, needs to see something a little bit different, there's still a real wanting for something that is going to be just material, a name you can sell, a name you can point to someone and say, boy, that guy's here. And now it kind of just feels like Cody Bellinger's that only dude. I don't know. That doesn't, like I said, Chapman isn't that guy to me. Rhys Hoskins isn't that guy to me. So no pressure, Blue Jays. No pressure. Anyways, let's take a quick break. Let's come back. Are the Leafs all right in net? Next. All right, I said I was going to talk about Leafs goaltending. Not really. I got more Shohei thoughts. I got to dump more on Shohei. Because I got Brady Quinn in the NFL next. Here's my Leafs take. Joe Woll having a sprained ankle, even though it's a high ankle sprain. Thank you to all the Twitter doctors that reminded me that an ankle sprain can be quite bad. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I needed that. Yes, of course an ankle sprain is bad. But it wasn't one where it happened with force. Like, it wasn't something where he fell and put a ton of pressure on the ankle, right? So you got to believe that the high ankle sprain is not going to be one that is of the worst kind of degree. That's my Twitter doctor analysis. But two, groin, knee, something that would have put him out for the season, would have been an abject nightmare for the Toronto Maple Leafs. They could not go through the entire season with Samsonov and Martin Jones. So to get that report or to get the news that he wasn't going to be out for the season was a huge win. And not only is he not going to be out for the season, if you look at the timelines, like Liljegren's, for example, also dealing with a high ankle sprain, it's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of super fast recovery, 5-ish weeks, longer, closer to 2 months. The NHL trade deadline now is in March. So you at least have time to get him back and evaluate what you have in net fully. Because I'm happy for Samsonov. I'm glad he got the shutout, but you could tell the way that the team played in front of him was, okay, we can't let this guy have any shots. He hadn't played in something like 15 days. He's capable. We've seen the ceiling. We know he can win with the Toronto Maple Leafs. I think he's actually 5-1 this year now, as his just record with the team. So yeah, Samsonov is not the worst case scenario, but he has a sub 900 save this year. His overall career numbers are similar to that. And yeah, Martin Jones is long in the tooth and past waivers. Their goaltending situation for a team that, again, numerically, basically across the board, is a middling team, 5-on-5. I don't think that they could have below average in net. I don't even think that they could just have average in net. Feel as though they need to have above average. If we're talking about contention, not just making the playoffs, because who cares? Making the playoffs isn't the goal for the Toronto Maple Leafs anymore. But yeah, they couldn't go out at the deadline and then add goaltender to their shopping list. There was just too many things on the list. Tree Living was going to come home from the store and, oh, please don't send me back out. I know I forgot. Anyway, the last Ohtani thought. I'm going to root against the Dodgers the way that I rooted against the Clippers when Kawhi went there. The way I root against the Oklahoma City Thunder, who stole my basketball team. The way I root against the Montreal Canadiens. Like, they have joined my Mount Rushmore of just teams I despise. If the Yankees and the Dodgers were in a World Series tomorrow, I wouldn't even have a second to hesitate as to who I would be cheering for. Go Yankees. I would be in pinstripes. I would be wearing a big gold chain. And that's it. The Bronx. I would be all that. I would be all about it. I would be all about it, about it, about it. I hate the Dodgers. And they did nothing wrong. All they did was try to offer the best baseball player the most amount of money, and they built a competent organization and have a deep farm system, and they play in LA. I don't care. I hate them. I hate the Dodgers. I hope Shohei Ohtani never wins. I hope we don't ever see him in a playoff game. I know that's impossible, but there would be nothing sweeter than a lost career for Shohei. I usually cheer for the greats, and I usually even come around on the greats. Like, I hated Kobe's whole career. I hated Kobe Bryant. And at the end of Kobe's career, I was so nostalgic for Kobe, and I just went, I'll miss you, Kobe. I hated Michael Jordan. I hated him growing up. He was my number one villain as a kid. I can't, if you were like, hey, who's the athlete that you hated the most in your life? It's like, yeah, Kobe and MJ. And by the ends of their careers, I was like, we saw a secret. I hope we never see Shohei in a World Series. Ever. I don't know if I can go to those games, though, when the Dodgers come to town. I just think it might be too traumatic. People are like, oh, I want to go and boo. And some people say, like, you shouldn't boo. I think you should do whatever the hell you want. Like, whatever helps you get over the trauma that is thinking you were getting Shohei and then not getting Shohei. And, yeah, being told, like, you're an idiot for thinking you're getting Shohei. Like, by every single fan base. Like, it's just, yeah. You do whatever you got to do to get it out. But, man, oh, man. I hate the Dodgers. And, yeah, Shohei Ohtani. He's, like, at least Kawhi left here with giving a championship to the city, right? Where people are like, you can't criticize Kawhi. He gave you a chip. I went, yes, I can criticize him. I think he broke the covenant of basketball, which is run it back. I think he went to a lesser basketball situation. I think he should be criticized for that. But he did leave a championship here. You know, he left the residue of, hey, winning and belief and all those different things I talk about. Shohei Ohtani just, yeah. We would have loved you the most. We would have loved you the most, man. We needed you. And now, I hate your guts. Anyway, quick break. Let's come back. The Buffalo Bills didn't break their fans' hearts. Incredible stuff. But, whoa, Patrick Mahomes. Who cried more? Blue Jays fans or Patrick Mahomes? This next. My personal MVPs as of today goes Dak 1, Brock Purdy 2. And it's very close between the two of them. But it's Dak 1, Brock Purdy 2, Tyreek 3. Tyreek, his betting total for tonight is 106.5 receiving yards. 106.5. I just feel like that deserves a lot of respect. But yeah, that's my top three in MVP right now. My biggest takes from yesterday is that the Eagles always felt fishy this entire year. And yes, they've had the schedule. And I know, you know, Nick is behind the glass, he's a big Eagles fan. And he's crying about the schedule. It's like, that's what happens when you're a good team, is you play a tougher schedule. Like, I know some fans don't understand that, but it's been that way for a very long time, Nick. They've had that for a very long time. You win a lot of games, your schedule the next year is harder. That's how it works. And also, the NFL kind of sucks this year. So the whole, like, everybody has a hard schedule thing. It's like, yeah, there's like five good teams. So whatever. The Eagles felt fishy all year, and they continue to have like a stink around them. I'm not really sure what it is. I'll talk to Brady about it. Cowboys weirdly do feel like the number two team in football, but it's counteracted by how badly the Niners own them. And that the Niners wagon is just, like, everyone's excited about the Cowboys because they were on the standalone game, but it's the Niners wagon is just chugging along. You know, they had 8 plays of 25 or more yards yesterday against the Seahawks? 8. It's just splash play, splash play, splash play. Good night. And then the biggest thing is, Patrick Mahomes is having a heel turn moment. This is a real heel turn moment. Nobody likes a crybaby. Nobody likes a sore loser. And now the guy who has benefited many times from the officials has one that is correctly called and goes against him and has a meltdown like that. I think it's pretty telling of how he's feeling about his Kansas City Chiefs and their chances of, going back to try to grab another Super Bowl. Brady Quinn, our Monday Morning Insider, former NFL QB. What's up, brother?
Not much, JD. And yeah, it was obviously a fun play. As soon as you saw the flag go up, you're kind of thinking to yourself, all right, this may be coming back. So I kind of had measured excitement with watching what Kelsey was able to do to Kadarius Toney. But the reality is he was offsides.
Yeah.
And this has also been a point of emphasis this year in the NFL. The only gripe I think ultimately Kansas City would have, and I actually try to go back and watch the TV copy, and you can't tell before Kadarius Toney gets lined up, if he indeed does look out at the line judge.
Yeah, get the warning.
To see or not. Should have moved off. So it's hard to tell, but Tracy Wolfson did have a report, and they're claiming that he did. I guess only Kadarius Toney and the line judge really know the truth but between it. But at the end of the day, it was a penalty. It should have been called. And to your point, all teams benefit at some point in time from a call or a no call at times.
Dude.
And in this instance, it just happened to be one that came back to get him.
I just, like, the podium was rough for Mahomes. I hated the podium. It was ugly. But the worst thing to me is when it's done and he has his meltdown on the sideline, fine. Show some emotion. Have your teammates fake hold you back from the officials, like whatever the hell that was. Spike your helmet. Do all those things. When he went to shake hands with Josh Allen, and these two guys have been like going toe-to-toe, there should be – I don't want to sound like it's too preachy here, but I almost feel like, dude, the handshake is just, you know, some respect and, hey, good game. And he yells at Allen, worst bleeping call I've ever seen in my life. And just pouts off. And I was like, that just is a bad look, man. And I know they're feeling frustrated, but I feel like that's about way more than the officials.
Yeah, no, it is. It's about the wide receivers. I mean, honestly, if you look at how the season's gone between the drops, which I think Kansas City's leading the league, at least they were maybe going into that game. Obviously this particular call, this play comes back due to a wide receiver lining up offsides, which is football 101, right? Like if you teach a kid, if you're teaching a wide receiver and they first start playing tackle football, even in 7-on-7 flag football, that you're probably looking at an official and saying, like, is he on sides or not? Like, do I need to move back? Do I need to move up? So you know, it's football 101 to have that be able to bring back, you know, what could have been a game-winning score amongst all the other frustrations as far as the drops, lack of development, guys not being in the right place at the right time. Yeah, I could imagine it's kind of boiled over. And I think also it's boiled over because look at the AFC playoff picture, JD.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of Lamar Jackson, the Baltimore Ravens, who do you think is the other quarterback he would not want to see in a playoff scenario?
Yeah, that guy.
Probably Buffalo Bills and Josh Allen.
Mm-hmm.
And now this not only hurts them, not getting the number one overall seed, home field advantage, all that stuff,
mm-hmm.
but it also keeps the Bills' hopes alive, where the Bills now are very much still in this thing, very much with an opportunity to potentially take on the Kansas City Chiefs. And I think, you know, Patrick Mahomes understands how difficult a road it is through the AFC with how many competitive teams there are. And the frustration is mounting. It's boiling.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point, I think the toughest thing was, we'd all agree, Patrick Mahomes is the best quarterback on the face of this planet right now. That's the moment where I think as a leader, as a role model, all those things, you can be emotional. You can showcase your, you know, disgust and frustration.
Mm-hmm.
But then you got to move on. And if you're chasing Tom Brady, which every quarterback who is talented like Patrick Mahomes should, because he's got the greatest resume of all time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tom Brady might have complained about some things from time to time, but for the most part, kind of just moved on. You know, kind of emulated a lot of what you saw from Belichick. And just like, hey, we're on to Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. You know, in this case, you're on to the next opponent. You're on to the, you know, hey, we could have done other things better, right? That's usually how he kind of handled things, talked about it. I'm sure people could find sound bites and pull from that. But so I don't want to make too much of this because it's not like we see this all the time for Patrick Mahomes. I just think it's been a frustrating season.
Yeah.
And for a lot of the aforementioned reasons, it came to a boiling point in this instance.
Just if I'm him, I'm looking at it going, all right, I'm watching Tyreek. I just said, you know what Tyreek's line is tonight in that Titans game for his receiving total? 106 and a half
yards. 100 yards.
Yeah, 106 and a half yards. I do a lot of sports betting, Brady. I don't often see 96 or 106 and a half. Like, usually the top tier receivers in a big game against a friendly opponent, it's like 92 to 95. That's like you say, this is, yeah, 10 yard, more than 10 yards for Tyreek. The guy is a absolute freak of nature. He's got some, his like Pro Football Focus stats and all the really nerdy numbers are basically, this guy is not just the greatest receiver right now, but like one of the greatest receivers of a generation. They let him walk and they turn him into defensive pieces and they went, all right. And they just kept going like, hey, man, we're going to go on the cheap. We're going to go on the cheap, on the cheap, on the cheap, on the cheap. And I watched, you know, Valdez Scantling before the game. He had an interview with some reporter who asked him about the drops. And he was just like indignant about it, like furious about it. And I get it. Fine. You know, you're a pro athlete. You got a lot on your mind. You don't need to feel like you're apologizing to people all the time. But I would think that the last thing that you need right now is the feeling of, well, things aren't going for us because we're getting screwed over by the refs. It's not Scantling's fault for the drops and bad routes. It's not Sky Moore's fault for literally being, non-usable. It's not Rice's fault for the drops or the route tree that he has. It's not, you know, like, go on down the line. The excuses that you make for your receiver, Tony, it's like all this should be is, hey, this is attention to detail stuff that we need to have. There's no, we're not working with the margins that we used to. We're not the same Chiefs, so we need to be right. Focused. And so giving that excuse and having it be like the world is against us, I feel like that's counterproductive for the Chiefs. And seeing it resonate from the top, like where it's Mahomes and it's Andy Reid, that would worry me if I was a Chiefs fan.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a stat last night. What is it? However, 25,000 some plays. Andy Reid's called plays in the NFL. It's the first time they've gotten them. You know, offsides on offense. It's kind of crazy to think about. But
yeah.
You also bring up a good point of just the margin of error, right? When you're blowing teams out, you don't have to worry about a few bad calls here or there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how things used to be for the Chiefs in particular. It used to be that way at home. And if you, again, the comparison to the New England Patriots, I felt like they always were playing in tight games for the most part. Like mm-hmm. it always came down to the small margin of errors. And more often than not, other teams lost in those situations, or they lost focus, or they didn't, you know, capitalize when they had the opportunity. And those small little things added up to New England being the difference in the end. And I think that's where you hope, again, Patrick Mahomes, Andy Reid, could take a good long, hard look in the mirror and say, no one's coming to save you. Mm-hmm. There's no wide receiver who's coming in to save this roster, to save the day. And so they've got to expect more out of every single phase, not just offense, not just the wide receivers, but the protection, but the defense, but special teams everywhere. They've got to be better. They've got to be at their best situationally every single opportunity they get. because they don't have that margin of error anymore. And that's where you'd hope that he looks at this more as a challenge to get the most out of everyone else, to get the most out of himself moving forward, as opposed to saying like, well, you know, this is going to be a tough road and, you know, the refs are against us or whatever else, mm-hmm. you know, what other excuse you want to make in this case.
Okay. So you tapped on the other thing though, too, a little bit earlier there, and the feeling I had when I was watching this, and I actually think that there's like a, as a sports fan who believes in some of the mystic, you know, I hated that the Bills were front runners last year. Like, I always hate when a tortured fan base is front runners and they start to really believe in themselves based on a regular season. I'm like, yo, no, show some humility and wait until the postseason. Bills is another crushing exit, and now it's like the window, and now it's like they've pushed their fans to the brink, and then they get this win, and I go, man, if you could just sneak in, you're kind of the dangerous team. Yeah, am I crazy to feel like, yeah, the Bills, if we're talking about like those scariest teams in the AFC right now, they've leapfrogged the Jags. Like, who's even in it? They've got to be in the top three. Like, they're there with the Chiefs and they're there with the Ravens. The potential of this team is higher than just about anybody else in the AFC.
Yeah, it's because of their quarterback. It's yeah. because of some of the pieces that they still have on defense, right? Still able to rush
defense
the pass,
scares
still
me.
Able to cover relatively well. You know, but I think when you see Cook involved the way he did, and, you know, Joe Brady's kind of, you know, helped them play a little more up-tempo, you know, utilize some different pieces, it just feels like it fits Josh Allen better. And I think if you're, again, if you're the Chiefs, if you're the Baltimore Ravens, that's probably not the team you want to see, right? Like, yeah. you don't want to see them get in as a wild card. You pray to God that somehow Jake Browning and the Cincinnati Bengals, you know, find yes. their way in, or Pittsburgh can maintain with Mitchell Trubisky until Kenny Pickett comes back, right? Like, those are the teams you'd rather see somehow find a way of making it, you know, regardless of how good defensively they are, or even their, you know, running backs. That's the lack of experience for some of those guys to play in the postseason, all that. That just adds up, that mounts up. So, I think there's a lot of frustration that's come from that. But if you look at the Bills, I mean, that's the thing that I like the most so far, is I think the way Joe Brady has, you know, incorporated different players in different spots, trying to find them different ways of getting them touches. And it feels like Josh Allen's playing looser, you know, with this group. It doesn't feel as rigid. It doesn't feel like he's playing as uptight about it. So, you know, kudos to them for making the change. And so far, I think in the small sample size, it's worked out. But they still have a lot of work left ahead of them. I think that Week 18 matchup is one of the more interesting ones.
Mm-hmm.
Because Miami could have the division locked up.
But want to keep them out.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, do you rest the players so they get the rest going into the wild card round? And this is assuming, obviously, they don't have the number one overall seed.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you play them and say, we'd love to knock out Buffalo, and so we don't have to worry about potentially seeing this game again?
Mm-hmm. I just, yeah. It's the other part of this, though, for me is everybody else stinks so bad. Like, the Texans lose Stroud, and I think they lost four other starters in that game.
Right.
And now they're down Tank Dell.
Really,
yeah, it's like, and yeah, they lost Anderson. It was a nightmare day for them, right? They not only lose the Jets, but they lose all their players. And I'm like, I don't still know. It feels like you guys are still a year away. Then you got the Colts who, yeah, get embarrassed by Jake Brown. Basically another Apple Cup win for Washington, if you really look at it. It's like, it's basically.
There you go.
It counts.
What a great reference.
Yeah,
what a great reference.
That basically counts. Yeah, you look at the Steelers, like, what, you think they're going to be around it? I genuinely do think kind of the Bengals are the frisky team out of all these. Everybody's 7-6 in the entire NFL. Like, everybody's 7-6, yeah. Especially in the AFC. I look at all these teams, and I'm like, none of you, I have no faith that any of you are going to be able to close out the season strong and actually hold the Bills underneath you.
No, I mean, not at this moment. Again, I think the Bills are the scariest team that may find their way in and make their way in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that the Chargers were even in the mix, but
no,
you know, Herbert, the right index finger, we don't know how long they'll be out. But yeah, I think the Broncos are the other really interesting one.
Yeah,
because of Russell Wilson's, you know, history. He's made some clutch plays before. He can make those dazzling plays. Their defense has gotten so much better. I kind of just go, look out. Like, that's the other team. And again, it goes back to the head coach having experience winning a Super Bowl. The quarterback, like, we won a Super Bowl, you know, much experience, you know, a lot of experience in the postseason. Like, when it really comes down to it, like, you get into those moments, you say, we just trust them more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we trust those players, those guys in those scenarios to be able to coach and play the type of game that wins playoff football. And so if those are four of the teams, four of the seven, which right now I'd say, you know, unless CJ Stroud comes back 100% healthy and they can get, you know, healthier. I know Tank Dell's not coming back, but
yeah.
if that were the case, like, Houston would be a fun team to see in there.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of that, like, I don't really have much faith in anyone else.
No,
when it comes down to it. It's those four teams that will be representing the AFC.
Yeah, Denver feels like they're getting in and they're going to be the team that could win a game, but I don't think they could go the distance. You know, like, could they knock off the Chiefs? I'm like, yep. Could you even knock off the Ravens? Yep. I just don't think that they'll be able to put consecutive wins together.
I don't know. I'm not betting against Sean Payton and this team and Russell Wilson, the way this whole thing's coming together. It feels like that. If it was that team that was a slow burn that's now starting to, you know, hit that upswing, and they're really starting to take off, and they're starting to feel confident in themselves and their ability. I mean, Courtland Sutton's catch might be the catch of the year this past week. But
he's
just
nasty.
I don't know. I wouldn't bet against the experience of that and everything and how it's working right now. Like, that team's just playing with a different sense of belief themselves.
All right, so speaking of different, last eight games for Dak, 69% completion percentage, nice. 2,444 yards, 25 touchdowns, only two picks, and they're 7-1. What's different about Dak and the Cowboys this year?
Obviously, Mike McCarthy calling plays. I mean, I think that's one of the things that you see just in contrast to, like, there's a lot of stats and numbers when Kellen Moore was there. But I think, well, two things. One, there's just some unfortunate interceptions. Like, if you go back through the interceptions, and when this became a talking point, because, like, people had, I don't know if they mistakenly recorded or reported on, like, what Dak said about interceptions before the season, but he essentially was saying, like, he's going to cut down those this year because something that was just unlucky, and he was right. Like, there's a number of, like, batted passes and different things where it's just, it's not going to happen again the next year, and it hasn't so far. So that's been part of it. He's not turning the football over quite as much. Now, the other thing is, if you look at the addition of Cooks with this team, who, again, slow start, they're starting to get him more involved. CeeDee Lamb's been phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But I think, by and large, like, he's just making better decisions with the football. They're finding different ways of just complementing players around CeeDee Lamb enough to really not be able to overly focus on him or just, you know, take him away. But it feels like there's different parts working within this offense with Mike McCarthy calling plays, as opposed to Kellen Moore, who I really thought when he went out to the Chargers, I'm like, oh, it's perfect. Like, everyone was ragging on the Chargers last year for being like, check down Charlie and not utilizing Justin Herbert's big arm. And then this year, it's kind of been the same thing. I was like, all right, well, maybe it was like a Kellen Moore deal, or, you know, maybe it's not, you know, maybe it's not even, you know, Justin Herbert. Maybe it's just like the play calling. There's conservative. It's what Brandon Staley wants. I don't know. But it does seem like there's a different contrast to Dak, at least, with how he's playing under Mike McCarthy and the way he's kind of enabled him, I think, maybe to have a little more freedom, too, within the offense and some of the things that he's doing out there in the field. But either way, he looks confident. He looks decisive. And I think both those things have led to him playing at an MVP level. I mean, here's the crazy thing is, I would make the case he's right now the leader in the clubhouse, probably next to Lamar Jackson. But what's crazy right now is just go tell me what the odds are to win the NFC East. Even though right now Dallas is ahead of Philly, just go look at the odds right now of who's going to win it, or who's, as of right now, what the odds are to win it.
Okay, looking.
It's going to surprise you a little bit because it's. I looked at it and said, wow, like, I didn't think Philly would be that big of a favorite.
Let's see here. NFC East winner. I have it as, Philly minus 300 favorite, Dallas plus 230. So, they're pretty.
But Dallas is ahead right now with four games to play. Now, Dallas is a much tougher road ahead. I want to say the next three teams they play all winning records.
They do.
Maybe even all. Yeah. And that's not the case for Philly. But a little bit surprising considering how good this team's been.
Yeah. The Cowboys are at the Bills, at the Dolphins, host the Lions, at Commanders. I'm sorry. I'm writing off our Lions. All year long, you and I were like rooting on Goff. We like this team, but that defense just sucks. And they can't contain any quarterback that can move. That's a big one for the Bills. Like, that's definitely the game of the week. I think the Cowboys will smash the Dolphins. I really do. Even on the road, I think that's going to be a big win for Dallas. So I don't know. If you think that the Eagles continue to drop games, it might be worth a sprinkle. But I think the bigger question is, like, what do you think is up with the Eagles? Do you think Hurts is healthy? There's some crazy takes flying around. Like, I saw, I think it was Carr that was saying bench him and put in Mariota. I was like, all right, like, let's not get a little too crazy here. But hey, all due respect, this is
there can be a, like, there's no truth. Like, it doesn't make sense to bench him.
No.
Mariota doesn't give you a better chance of winning.
Yeah.
But what he was doing was being critical of, hey, I feel like Jalen Hurts is leaving some throws out there in the field.
Yeah.
And I think early on in the first half, the last couple of weeks, you could kind of see that. It felt like they had some one-on-one opportunities on the outside, some guys coming open. And I don't know if Hurts was hesitant to pull the trigger or wasn't able to see it or didn't feel confident in whatever the concept was, just letting the ball go before the player got there. But there was a few times you saw that, you know, when Hurts was kind of playing the pocket. And you know, at times he would, you know, kind of seem to heat up more in the second half. He'd take off and run when he had to and all that. But, like, that's a fair criticism. And there's going to be times when a quarterback's going through a lull where he's not seeing the field quite as well. I would say he doesn't look healthy. That's the first thing. The second thing is he is leaving some throws out there on the field. Outside of that, I mean, their defense isn't as dominant. Like, let's be real about it. Like, ball security was clearly an issue in last night's game.
Yep.
But their defense, in particular in the secondary, is not locking, you know, teams down the way we've seen in the past, or at least last year. Their pass rush isn't as good as it has been, or at least as it was last year when they're as dominant as they were. So I think all parts, you know, of this team, at least what you're seeing on the field, are just not to the caliber of what they were a year ago. And that's not saying that they can't go to a Super Bowl, they can't be, you know, a great team when they get to the playoffs, but the truth of the matter is, like, they need to turn some things around. They have a soft schedule the rest of the way now, which might afford them to build a little bit more momentum, you know, off this losing streak. I mean, heck, what were we saying about the 49ers after a three-game losing streak? Right? I realized they weren't healthy, but we're not talking that way about them now. Now we're talking about them as the best team in the NFL and probably the heavy Super Bowl favorite the way they've been playing. You know, the Eagles could have some sort of transformation too right now where they find their groove going up against a soft schedule the rest of the way and build some of that momentum into the playoffs.
Yeah, I don't know. He doesn't look fully healthy because, like, it seems like every time he's getting hit, he looks like he's in even more pain. But to me, this is just their defense sucks. They can't defend the middle of the field at all. Like, their secondary is just not very good. It doesn't feel like they're dominant in any area. Even their pass rush, that their deep D line, years past with these Eagles teams, it just felt like, oh, man, they're getting to the quarterback. It's a nightmare for the quarterback. Like, their defense is just whatever. It's just a pretty mediocre team. They give up a ton of points. It puts a lot of pressure on the offense. And then Hurts is this player where he can have moments of brilliance where you look at him and go, boy, is this guy one of the best players in the NFL? But I think overall, it's just like we've created an expectation for him based on that Super Bowl, that game, that he is like one of the best guys in the NFL. And I just don't think that's actually the case. Like, I think the whole body of work tells you this is a guy who is in the top 10, but he's not in that top 3-4.
I think that's a fair take. I mean, look, this is one of those talented rosters. And I think that's largely, when you look at their success winning a Super Bowl with Nick Foles, I mean, you could see that then, right? I mean, it didn't matter if it was Carson Wentz and Nick Foles during that period of time or now with Jalen Hurts. Like, what's been the constant is Howie Roseman has built up this roster to be able to compete when football games get to the postseason. I mean, hell, you saw it with Chip Kelly. So I think it's a fair thing to say. Now, I think Jalen Hurts, though, when he is on, when he is at his very best and he is 100% healthy.
Top of the top.
It is one of those top guys.
Yeah.
Like, that, he's tough to stop, and especially with what's playing out around him.
Yeah.
It's no different than, like, for example, if you're talking about Brock Purdy. Like, Brock Purdy on another team, another roster, is he as good? No, but he's still going to be a damn good quarterback.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter that, you know, he's still going to be a good decision maker. He's still going to be accurate. He's still going to be able to extend plays, all the things you're seeing him do for San Francisco. The difference is now you throw to a bunch of guys who can get your yards after the catch and break tackles. I think San Francisco is like sixth in the NFL right now as far as that goes. So, you know, all of that can be true. Like, both things can be true, and it doesn't take away from what the quarterback is.
Yeah.
It's kind of the fault of what it's always been at playing quarterback is you always get too much appreciation for when things go well, and you get too much blame when things go wrong. And that's because you're a byproduct of really, and most times, what's out around you. But I think for Jalen Hurts, it'd be nice to see him get back to 100% where he's healthy. And I feel like you're not kind of wincing or almost, you know, every time he goes down, like, get up, you know, like you're scared that something's going to be wrong. And maybe that's just because of some of the shots earlier in the season, but it feels like that right now, like they're almost kind of limping along to the end of the season.
Dude, you know who he is? He's Jimmy Butler, where it's like he's the tough guy who every once in a while can have the games where say, hey, is he one of the top five players in the NBA? But then, no, most parts, like, no, Jimmy Butler's not one of the best five players in the NBA. But he's got some mythos around him because of the winning and the toughness and the tenacity and the physicality. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's like he really elevates it at times. But sometimes it's just it's not all the way there. And then you have to recognize that there are other better superstars in the NBA.
Is this your take purely because the in-season tournament is now over?
So I just thought about this right away.
Whatever the hell that was. I mean, look, I get it.
You didn't like it?
The court's different. So, yeah. Like, I mean,
the ratings weren't
great. I just don't get
the point
of it. I know they do it in Europe, you know? We don't need to copy everything that they do in other European leagues and whatnot.
That's the issue.
Mean, is anyone going to remember back if the Lakers don't win the NBA Finals that the Lakers won the in-season tournament? Like, does anyone care?
No.
Because I don't.
This is the
It seems like the most pointless thing in the world.
So There's a war happening between NBA nerds on Twitter right now. It's like some people are like, the ratings were up 23% from November games. And then other people are going, well, actually, they're way below what you would expect for something that has this level of investment from a monetary and from a, advertising standpoint, especially considering, like, it had LeBron. I think that in the States, it only did something like 1.6 million the final, just not an overly terrific number, especially since it wasn't up against football.
Your regular season, season college football can beat those.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Oh, absolutely it can. People are going, hey, was it a success? Was it not? I think it's like, it's a thing that is fine to have. It's a thing that if you get the right team and a right breakout player, it can amplify that a little bit like it did for Tyrese Halliburton. But overall, this is the this is North America. Like, we don't care about the secondary tournament things, right? Like, it's not, I just don't think that there's going to be space for this. And ultimately, we'll do it year over year over year, and I'm glad that we might get a little bit better basketball, and you can use it as a test for the postseason. But unless there's some kind of massive stake for a fan that involves like a draft pick or something along those lines, I don't think it's ever going to have its like, if the goal is just, hey, make the regular season slightly more exciting, mission accomplished. If the goal is to actually turn it into something that's like a desirable product that you're selling to Amazon or Netflix or another digital streamer where they're going to put it, I don't know. Like, that part of it, I don't know how that ever becomes something.
If you have to create something like this to create more intrigue or try to draw a bigger, attention from viewership, et cetera, I think it says there's something, a bigger issue with your product, right? Like, if you have to go to the lengths of like feeling like, hey, we're going to have, paint our courts different, it's going to look different, so this in-season tournament, and guys going to play, and they'll get bonuses. It's just like, there's probably a greater issue with your league if you really feel it's necessary to do this. I've said, and I will always say, stop trying to compete with the NFL. Mm-hmm. Like, they've already won. So if the NBA was smart, they'd push back the season. And I don't know why they don't do this. Have Christmas Day be the start of your season, or even pick some point in time afterwards. Because right now you can look at the lineup for Christmas Day NBA, mm-hmm. and they'll get some attention to it. But the reality is, it would get lost amongst everything that's happening in the NFL.
Well, what's the NFL game on Christmas Day? Isn't there a good one?
Maybe, but I'll tell you this much. I'd rather watch that over even the best NBA game that's on that.
Well, yeah, you're Brady Quinn. It'd be pretty weird if it was the other way around.
Right, I understood. But, like, look, I grew up a big Cavs fan. I love LeBron. We're the same class in high school and all that. He's an Ohio guy.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't feel like they're positioning their players and stars to be able to warrant the attention that they deserve. And obviously the league is what it is now, and we're on an entirely different tangent. I guess my point is, they can't compete with the NFL, so stop trying. Like, stop trying to do these gimmicky things. Just push the start of the season back and play into a portion of the year where you don't have to deal with football at all to any degree.
Yeah, the problem is, if you keep the 82-game schedule, nobody wants to be watching NBA basketball in July and August,
That's where I disagree, because I would much rather watch that than baseball. All right.
Well, then,
give me NBA and
you're
hockey.
You're just taking out the Tommy gun and just gunning down all the leagues. You're like, everybody sucks but football. Like, yeah, that's the thing, is football.
No, there's a pecking order, though. Let's be real. There's a pecking order. If you had to pick, all right, after that NFL game goes on and you have an NBA game and your hockey, like, I personally, I've grown to love hockey. And so now,
you don't have to lie just because you're on in Canada, bro. You can just tell the truth. You love hockey. Come on.
My brother-in-law plays for the Avalanche.
All right, so that's fair.
I'm drinking from the Stanley Cup. I was fortunate enough, because of him winning it. I got to experience that. We got to spend time with the guys, the gentlemen who obviously protect the cup. So it was, heard a lot of great stories. I mean, Lord Stanley's a special thing. So I've grown accustomed to that.
Jack Johnson let you sip from the cup. Now you're like, I'm a big hockey guy. I'm all about hockey.
It actually happened before that, because we used to go to the Panthers games.
Yeah.
Tickets were that cheap before the new ownership group took over. And now they've done such an amazing job with the Panthers that it's been fun to see a team that couldn't sell out, didn't have fans. Now it's like an exciting fan base.
Wait, so are you a Panthers fan or an Avs fan?
It's been fun to watch. Say that again?
Are you a Panthers fan or an Avs fan?
I would like to say that I'm an Avalanche fan first, because of Nintendo 64. I used to grow up playing with Joe Sakic, Peter Forsberg, all that back when I was young. And then now, because my brother-in-law is there, I family over the Panthers, but Panthers second.
Panthers second. See, if had I known this, because you beat us in the playoffs last year, this would have never happened. I would have never arranged for a Panthers fan to be on here with me every single week, like a covert actual
Panthers. I'm sorry. It was an exciting time.
And also,
it was an exciting time.
You're like, oh, I'm such an Ohio guy. It's like, yeah, where are the Blue Jackets then? Like, where are the Blue Jackets, Brady? It's like, not
they're
even
third.
There. They're somewhere in there.
Third.
Yeah, they're third. Oh, dude, here's the thing.
Third.
You could... No,
well,
one, no one should be a Columbus fan.
No
one should be a Columbus fan. No one. It's the worst. That's like the jerseys are ugly. The team is always ugly. It's just a depressing. That's a depressing market. That's a really, really depressing fan base. But yeah, you're right. And by the way, the Christmas Day game is there's Eagles Giants, which will do a huge number. There's Chiefs Raiders, which who cares? But there's also a Ravens Niners game. At 8:15. So yeah, good luck to the NBA in your Christmas endeavor. The NFL has completely stolen your one thing that you had. But that's so rude. Just so that's such bully behavior by the NFL to come in there and just say we're not just doing one game anymore. We're doing three games, and we're going to put some absolute ratings bangers in here and just kick you right in the teeth and try to take all the shine off of your special day. Okay, before you go, I do have to ask you on one last guy. Where are you at with Fields? Because I actually have moments where I go back and I'm fully out and I'm saying, oh, well, they got to draft the guy with that Panthers pick. And then I have little flashes like yesterday, and I know it's against that crappy Lions defense, but the last couple of weeks that he's at least shows a little something. I don't know. I just,
yeah,
I go back and forth more than I thought I would.
I think you see a couple of things. I think you see one, what he's capable of. When he's healthy, he's got something to throw to, and DJ Moore has been spectacular, and he's got a little bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
I think you see, too, when it's not having to be in a shootout all the time, the defense is playing better, too, so give them credit. Here's where I'm at. I mean, I obviously had the opportunity to follow Justin from college to the NFL now,
mm-hmm.
and you know, he's getting to the point where I think he is a guy, he's a franchise guy, and he's only going to continue to get better. Like, I truly do believe that. Now, the problem is he might have a new head coach next year, could be a different offense. And obviously, if they, you know, want to go a different direction, he could be somewhere else playing. So that'll stunt his growth to a degree. But you have the opportunity to maybe trade out of that spot and accumulate even more picks. Because mm-hmm. this roster is devoid of some talent. But, like, since they got Montez Sweat, the defense looks a lot better. Since they got DJ Moore, all of a sudden Justin Fields is a better quarterback. Like, that's always how it works. It always works hand in hand. So I'm a believer in him. I just know, look, he's not Ryan Poles' guy.
Mm-hmm.
They have a number one overall pick, so there's power in that. Obviously, they have two, you know, top five picks at this point. And on top of that, if you have the chance of getting a guy who you feel like is a generational talent, a quarterback, they're going to go that direction, right? Because they have to – no, it would be cheaper to go draft a Caleb Williams and not sign Justin Fields to an extension, which is looming and coming, than it would be to draft other players and then sign Fields to the extension. But I do think he can be a franchise guy. I think he's kind of showcasing that and improving it, despite the fact that it's been a tough situation there for him throughout the course of his career since he's been there.
I've at least had a few moments where I'm like, maybe you do just trade back. You let somebody else go up and you do the double. You trade back twice out of the one spot. Grab, I don't know, Marvin Harrison Jr. with whatever your pick, if you can move back into two or something. There's at least an interesting case for it, which I didn't think there was going to be, you know, even a month ago.
You could get a top tackle. You could get Malik Nabers if they can't get Marvin Harrison Jr. That young man at LSU is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. There's some other receivers you could throw into the conversation. But, like, there's definitely a case to be made for Justin Fields staying, being the guy, and then, you know, drafting around him and seeing what you can get to help build up this roster.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing it. Hey, man, this was fun this week.
Yeah. Always a good time. Glad we got to talk some hockey, too.
Yeah, anytime. Anytime you got hockey takes, you just let me know and you can fire them out. And we'll make sure that you can, your happiness about the Avalanche or your happiness about the Panthers, you can let that be known to a market that's starving for, you know, just one of the successes that those two teams have had.
All right. Well, we'll have to talk about that next week, then.
See you, buddy. Brady Quinn, our Monday Morning Insider, former NFL QB. I think that Bears fans have already made up their decision on Fields. Like, they hate him. And now they got to kind of... And I actually stinkily know a couple of Bears fans. Maybe I'm just speaking to the few that I know. But that it's like they had the pick and they were ready for Caleb Williams and they're ready. And they should probably do it if they think that he is going to be a superstar. But yeah, Fields just, he does. He has these flashes, and I go, all right, he's probably always going to make some mistakes, and he's probably always going to run it a little bit too much, but hard to find an athlete and a gamer like that. And here's what I will say. The truth of the matter is, I kind of hope the Seahawks trade for Justin Fields. I'm kind of in the hope that they draft a quarterback and then Seattle can jump in there and steal him on the cheap and actually give me an exciting quarterback to watch for a season. Limp Bizkit will be coming to Budweiser Stage next year on July 24th. And as a part of their Loserville tour, we are giving away tickets to enter. All you got to do is tune in to the episodes of this show, the JD Bunkus podcast, and listen for the code word. Then text that code word to 590-590. Today's code word is dad vibes. So text dad vibes to 590-590 for your chance to win. We'll be giving away one more pair tomorrow. And if you don't win with us, you can get them on ticketmaster.ca. Quick break. Let's come back. Hit what we missed. Okay, before I talk, both you guys had interesting sports fans weekends. My guys behind the glass, Nick and Armin. Because God forbid you care about the local teams. God forbid. God forbid. But Eagles fan and Lakers fan. Nick, before Nick Blackmore, before we start doing Armin stuff, what did you think of my Jimmy Butler analogy about Jalen Hurts? I kind of think I nailed that. I think that was like an 11 out of 10 analogy. Nope, doesn't have his mic on. There we go.
I thought he was going to turn on my mic for me. I thought I had that privilege.
Oh, wow. You threw Armin under the bus. That's the way you start today? This is Monday, and you want the vibes to start with you just ripping Armin, saying it's his fault for not turning your mic on. No, it's cool. We got it.
Jalen Hurts being some sort of model guy that's out there, like just some guy that's playing the GQ guy playing the game of football. Really not that big of a deal. I think he's just having a couple of bad games. You know, it happens. It's football.
So you don't like my analogy? That was the question. Jimmy Butler. Okay, never mind. I don't know what's happening.
I thought the Jimmy Butler analogy was pretty good, though.
Okay. I'm very confused. All right, off of your thing then, because that was, I don't know. Your Lakers. Did you, be honest, did you celebrate it?
I was very happy Saturday night. Can't say I celebrated it, but I was into it. I was very into it.
So was I. I was shockingly into it, but that's because I put a huge bet down on the Lakers. I already kind of gave my take with Brady about where I'm at on the in-season tournament in general once it's done. I think it's pretty simple. Good for breakout guys like Halliburton. Great for fan bases that get that first home game where they're kind of hungry for something and you get a performance. Good for trying to project forward to the playoffs to a certain degree to see kind of who is a guy, who could be scary, right? The lesson we learned from Halliburton was if you get into a playoff series with this guy, he is going to be able to go toe-to-toe with just about any superstar in the NBA from a scoring standpoint, right? Like that's a real thing. The other part is knockout one-off elimination games are just always fun. The only problem is you do need to feel like there's a little bit more stakes. And that's why the simple tweak is give the fans a little tiny something. Give the fans like a little tiny thing that makes them a little bit more invested in the actual win itself beyond what's going on with the players and their finances. So I liked it. I think it's all right. I think it'll be a novelty, but I do worry that it's not going to... If they don't make those tweaks, I don't know what it looks like in 3 years. Like, it was fine this year. Even next year when they run it back, I kind of feel like it's going to be a, all right, the in-season tournament is here. All right, cool. Nice. They're still doing the courts. They're still going to do this, huh? Just feels like a really heavy investment for something that I just not sure what the ceiling is.
Well, I think LeBron buying in JD does a lot because even when the Lakers were celebrating in the locker room, I was watching it live and it felt like no one wanted to go grab the champagne and start popping it because they thought they would get memed, you know what I mean? And they thought they would get roasted. And just LeBron taking the initiative to be like, nah, man, I'm not too cool for this. And doing that, I think that raised the bar of like everyone in the future wanting to, you know, go after it. Go get the money, go get the trophy, whatever it is.
See, I give LeBron credit. I give him credit that he bought into this thing, that he played as hard as he did, that he actually won it. But I think that that actually kind of proves the point of how sort of meaningless it is still. That, yeah, and like maybe things are different in 15, 20 years. Maybe this is a smart investment down the line. I really don't want to sound overly critical of it because, again, I do think that it was fun. It had its moments. That's all you can ask for. It created conversation around a league, which is really that's almost the biggest win out of all of this, is that like we were talking about the NBA in ways that we wouldn't have if there was no in-season tournament right now. But what happens after that novelty, right? Like, I think the NBA, one of the problems it has at times is that it's way too insular with the way that it's covered. Like, it's a cool league where everybody that covers it is very, very, like, invested in what each other's takes are. And it's like NBA Twitter, it's its own little echo chamber. And I feel like everyone was just like, it's a success. It's great. We're talking about basketball. Ratings were up compared to November. But I like the rest of the sporting world, so I was at a sports bar Saturday night, right? I watched the game with Blake. The Leafs ended. We didn't think that it was going to be on the Leafs. Duh. Leafs end. They left on the hockey. This is a savvy sports bar. They had the in-season tournament game on, but no sound. It was on in the corner.
Yeah, secondary.
It was still secondary to, I think it was Sabres, Habs, maybe. I don't know. Sabres somebody, Habs somebody. I wasn't even really paying attention. Well, I was kind of paying attention, but, you know, a couple of beers. So I forget. My point is like, It wasn't anybody showing up for an in-season tournament game at a prominent Toronto sports bar. It was, all right, yeah, that's on too. And then it kind of finishes and the Lakers won it. And you went, all right, yeah, LeBron's celebrating it. And they had the imagery looks like an NBA championship, right? Because there's hats and there's merch and they're walking around and it kind of feels like a faux title and it looked a bit corny. And even though LeBron invested in it and even though he was there, it actually, the only angle that you could take with LeBron and his kind of legacy was a joking one, right? To be, well, Kobe never won an in-season tournament. Michael never won an in-season tournament. LeBron did it.
Well, I think that will be cool if it actually lasts. If in 25 years you could look back and be like, that first one was LeBron. That's insane.
Yeah, that's what I thought too, was if they do stick with it, if they keep it year over year, if it actually does become something that eventually you call it like the MVP of that tournament, the LeBron and blah, blah, blah. You go on down the line and that's what it becomes. So, yeah, I think good for LeBron that he tried to give the legitimacy to that tournament. Good for LeBron that he won. Good for viewers that we got a couple of fun games. Got to keep it as a one-off. Don't change that for part of the formula. Like, it has to feel like anything could happen in the one-game situation, that another team isn't making big adjustments. That part is fun. I actually think that you expand the field if you're going to do this thing. Like, just include, I know we have the play-in games or whatever, but expand the field a tiny little bit. Have a couple more games at people's home court so that we get the experience of the fans being excited for that game. Try to continue to avoid the NFL as much as possible. You sort of have to do that. But then add a little piece to fan stakes. It sucks because draft pick feels so, like it almost feels too much. The idea that what? All of a sudden someone's going to get bumped down. You won the in-season tournament. You could get two picks, right? Like, I don't know. I don't know how that operates. Maybe you get a little bit extra cap space or something. There's got to be a little element of it to the fans that's more than the players getting more money, the rich getting richer, or like us having to worry about guys who make $1 million that they get the $500,000. It's an awesome story. That's great. But everybody on that bench is still making more money than you and I, right? All the G Leaguers. So it's just, it's difficult to feel too much excitement for that. And yeah, I don't think that Pacers fans who were sold to us as the ones who will care about this tournament the most because they've never won anything, I don't think that any of them woke up Sunday and were like us with Shohei staring at the ceiling going, we're never going to win an in-season tournament.
No, that's true. They did have a big watch party back
in
Indiana.
Sure, buddy, yes, of course.
They cared.
But that's it. It's like a party. It's an event. It's something that you go to. But then ultimately the stakes don't matter. And I don't know how that, like, again, it's a novelty. We see this here. This is an event city. We can relate to that more than anything. Had Toronto been in the in-season tournament, had there been a really sexy Friday night in-season tournament game with stakes for the Raptors to go to it, people here would have bought in. People here would have cared about it. But when you lose, that's the problem, is if you lose a game and it doesn't feel like you lost anything, what does that really say? Yeah. And yeah, the fact that they only did 1.6 mil on the Saturday night, and it had LeBron and it had Tyrese Halliburton. Like, it was kind of a perfect break for them in terms of, yeah, maybe they would have done if it was Lakers Celtics or something. I'm sure they would have rather another traditional market. But the way that it was sold to us was, this is perfect to have the established old guard guys versus the new up-and-coming plucky teams. And it didn't do a great number. So, yeah. And then when it ended, I thought, all right, like, that was fine. I'm curious what it's going to feel like next year without any changes in the stakes. So kudos to the NBA for trying, because that's what you should do as leagues. I want to be complimentary to them for that. But this one does feel like a bit of an uphill battle, and yeah.
Can I throw something at you?
Yeah, sure.
A suggestion I saw was that instead of these random groups, I have no idea how they picked them, why don't you do division by division? You play the same team every year in the tournament, so you build up a bit more rivalry and stuff. Like, I like that. I think that can make a difference. Now, it doesn't add anything for the fans, like you said, maybe, but if the rivalries start to juice up, then it's possible.
Oh, here's the other thing. There's so much player movement in the NBA that you go, this wouldn't even be the same guys. I don't know. I don't think you can manufacture rivalries like that and not through the in-season tournament. I think they happen from year over year in the meaningful games. But maybe, again, if they take swings and they keep trying it, I'm going to keep watching it. I'll keep doing it. I didn't have a single person who ever messaged me that wasn't someone I work with, essentially, who has to cover the in-season tournament, who had an in-season tournament thought, okay? Like, it was very much a NBA Twitter, NBA coverage tournament. And then I think the rest of the world kind of went on and went, all right. All right, okay. All right, it's tight. I got
kind of like the bubble.
No, the bubble was for a real championship. Like, that was a completely different thing. And it was the first league back, and everybody was watching, and it was huge. And it was like, guys were inside, and we had a million different storylines. Like, no. This is, the bubble had real stakes. And the bubble was major stakes. It was, you can't even leave the, remember, who was the guy that went and got food? There was one guy who got food.
Lou Will.
No, that was before. He had the lemon pepper chicken wings. Yeah. But that was before. I mean, there was like a Bruno Caboclo type of guy. I think it might have even been Bruno Caboclo. Oh. But it was like someone who left the actual thing to get DoorDash or something.
Yeah, he was on the rock. His Daniel House. Daniel House.
Yeah, but so it was something like that. No, the bubble was huge. We needed the bubble. We had no sports, and this was our path back. It looks a little weird now, and I think that there's like some slight asterisks to them, but no, there was genuine excitement just to have sports back. I was so grateful to have sports back. The tournament, it was just like, let's just say this. I'm excited that they did it. There's no way too much time I've done on this. I'm happy that they did it, but if they told me tomorrow, hey, there's no more in-season tournament next year, I wouldn't be like, no, you gotta keep it. You can't take it away now. We've gotten used to it.
Okay, this is unfair with 30 seconds left, but how would you feel NHL got it, honestly?
No, it would be the stupidest thing ever. You cannot have it for hockey.
Yeah?
No. In-season tournament for hockey. It does not work. The sport is supposed to be too physical. I know it's not anymore, but yeah, I saw some people kick that around on Twitter. It was like a cheap pop for Twitter of like, no, the NHL should be trying more things. Absolutely. They should be more of a creative league, but the in-season tournament for hockey, like, no. Imagine you saw Joe Wohl get hurt in an in-season tournament. No. Anyway, leave 5 stars, and I'll see you tomorrow.